Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Lynn Bassanese, the acting director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum, and it is my pleasure to welcome you all here this afternoon. We're celebrating the 76th anniversary of the Social Security Act, that monumental piece of legislation that forever changed the relationship between the federal government and the American people. I hope after the talk and the cake, you'll all go over to the library and visit our exhibit, which is called Our Plain Duty, FDR and America's Social Security, and please go as our guests. I'm happy to welcome back this afternoon two members of the library's extended family. Our speaker, Chris Bryseth, is the former president of the Roosevelt Institute and the former executive director and current senior fellow from the Roosevelt Institute, David Woolner. David has graciously agreed to come today to give us a little history lesson and then introduce Chris. Chris's book has added so much to the history and the impact of Social Security, and we are so delighted that he has agreed to come here and talk to all of you about it. And A Promise to All Generations is the title, and I know you'll enjoy reading it, and we hope that you will purchase it after this book talk, and Chris will be glad to sign it for you. So without further ado, please welcome David Woolner.
Well, good day, everybody. It's nice to be back at the FDR Library on a Sunday afternoon, and great to be back with old friends. I want to thank Lynn Bassanese and Cliff Lowby for inviting me to be here today to introduce Chris and give a little background. I'm not going to go on too long because I'm sure Chris is going to fill you in on the details of Social Security, but I thought it would be perhaps useful to just kind of remind everybody what the United States was like in 1933 when Franklin Roosevelt took office. As you all know, unemployment nationwide was running at 25%, which seems just impossible to imagine. But in other places in the country, Chicago, Detroit, and other cities, unemployment had topped 50%. The state of Georgia essentially shut down its school system in March of 33 because they could no longer afford to pay the teachers. The stock market had declined by this point over 60%. Banks across the country had closed, over 11,000 banks had closed, and the banking system essentially had ceased to function when Roosevelt took office. So it was a crisis that is simply unimaginable today. Even with the great difficulties we're facing today. And sometimes I like to remind my students that part of the reason that things haven't gotten as bad as they were in 33 is because of all the great programs that Franklin Roosevelt put in place, like Social Security. I also think it's important to remember that, of course, it was a global crisis. And when Roosevelt took office, Adolf Hitler was in power in Germany, in Nazi Germany. You had Italian fascists under Mussolini. You had Japanese militarism. Japanese had invaded Manchuria. So liberal democracy as we know it was kind of under siege worldwide. So it was a very, very dire moment in American history. And of course, the United States was completely unprepared for what happened. There simply wasn't the capacity within private charities and private organizations to try to deal with this kind of economic crisis. And as Lynn mentioned, getting over to the exhibit in the library is a good idea. Lynn and I are part of a team that's putting together a new permanent exhibit for the Roosevelt Library that'll be coming in the next couple of years. And we were very struck by a photograph that the designers had found, or the library archive staff had found, of Central Park in 1933. It looks like a shanty town with people camped out. You can see the Plaza Hotel in the distance, and the poverty is just unbelievable. So it was very, very dire. And of course, there wasn't any state to deal with this. There was, you know, there was no state there. There was no there in 1933. Most Americans had very little contact with the federal government. The only real contact with the federal government was through the post office, and that was about it. So we didn't have anything like the programs that we're so used to that came from the New Deal era. Well, when Chris and I were working together at the Roosevelt Institute, Chris came on in 2001. We got involved because, of course, there was an effort under the Bush administration to try to privatize Social Security in 2005, which, given what's been happening in the market, probably wouldn't have been all the wisest of ideas. And we felt that we should try to do something about this, and it was a very exciting time for the two of us. We worked very hard that year. That was 2005. It was the 70th anniversary. One of the things that we came up with was this idea of asking this new senator from Illinois to speak on this issue, whose name was Barack Obama, and we were very surprised and delighted when he agreed to give a national press club address in April of 2005 on Social Security, and it was his first major national address. It was Senator Obama's first national address, and wisely, this has gone into the book, so I urge you to read the book and to look in particular at President Obama's remarks, which were really interesting and really outstanding in the spring of 2005. And then we also had a birthday celebration on the front lawn of the library. And of course, you know, it was a very hot issue. It was a hot day, too. It was about 100 degrees. And it was a hot issue because Bush was pushing this privatization program, and we had over 1,000 people show up for a debate between Paul Krugman and Michael Tanner from the Cato Institute. Michael Tanner, by the way, was very gracious and opened his remark by saying that he understood that an event like this needed a sacrificial lamb. We also had the Commissioner of Social Security here, and she was wonderful. You know, she stayed out of the fray, so to speak. And the moderator that day was James Roosevelt Jr., who was the grandson of FDR and a former associate commissioner of Social Security under the Clinton administration. And he, too, had been very active that year in speaking out against the idea of privatization. And he also introduced Barack Obama at the National Press Club. So it was an exciting time to be working on this issue. And in all modesty, I think we felt that we did some good in trying to bring greater public awareness to the consequences that may have accrued from the idea of privatization. Well, it's hard for me to introduce Chris because I could go on and on and on and on about what a wonderful colleague and mentor he has been to me personally. Chris came on to become president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute in 2001. It was a very important moment in the development of the Roosevelt Institute and the FDR and our relationship with the FDR Presidential Library. A lot of new changes coming, including the construction of this building, the construction of the Vandenhoevel Gallery, and now the permanent exhibit change, which is coming in the next few years. I can't say enough about what a wonderful boss Chris was to work for, and I still call him boss. He doesn't like it, but I insist on calling him boss. Chris, as many of you know, was educated at UCLA in Southern California, and then went on to do a master's at Oxford and finally a PhD at Cornell University. And it was while he was at Cornell, at Telluride House, that he met Francis Perkins. And he wrote an article, which I've read, about that experience called The Francis Perkins I Knew. So he's had a kind of an affinity both for Social Security and for Francis Perkins for many, many years now. And I can think of no better person to put together this marvelous book than Chris Bryce. So without further ado, let me welcome Chris.
Thank you, Dave, and it is it's good to be home. This book actually picks up several other points that David made, the final essay is by James Roosevelt, an essay that he, or a speech he gave on the 75th anniversary, and I'm going to make some reference to it towards the end of my remarks. I have just come from the Telluride House. We're celebrating our 100th anniversary, and I gave my remarks yesterday morning as part of a panel on Francis Perkins's time living with us for 5 years in the house. The highlight for me was when she and I put together a seminar with Henry A. Wallace, and we had a whole weekend with the Vice President and the Secretary of Agriculture and the Secretary of Commerce. He and Francis Perkins were two of the only cabinet members that served the entire 12 years of the Roosevelt administration. And her time with us and the time I had with her, which was extensive, has led me in my retirement now to be a very active member of the board of the Francis Perkins Center, which is located on her home in Newcastle, Maine. It's a plot of land that goes back to the 1740s in her family. The house itself is from the 1830s and is lived in now by her grandson and only issue and his partner. And they together created this center, and I'm now a member of the board, and we produced this book. And we felt it was important in defending Social Security as a key part of her legacy, to make the case that this work that she and Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins and others were involved in was really a definitional part of America and the relationship of Americans to their government. We had our garden party last weekend in Newcastle. Some 200 people were there, and our keynoter is now responsible for another book, which I think is not yet in the library, but will be. And this is the reissue of Miss Perkins' book on Franklin Roosevelt, which she wrote the year after he died, called The Roosevelt I Knew. But you can tell from what David said that I was slavishly borrowing from her when I wrote the essay on Francis Perkins I Knew. Many people still regard this as the shrewdest portrait of Franklin Roosevelt extant. And I'm delighted that Penguin Books has brought this out. At the very beginning of the introduction, Adam Cohen, who has also the initial essay after my introduction in this book, former editorial writer for the New York Times and now one of Governor Cuomo's major domestic policy advisors, and the author of the book Nothing to Fear, which is focused on the first 100 days of the Roosevelt administration, says the following: "If American history textbooks accurately reflected the past, Francis Perkins would be recognized as one of the nation's greatest heroes, as iconic as Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Paine. Like Franklin, Perkins was a brilliant self-creation. There had not been anyone like her before, and there has not been anyone like her since. Like Paine, Perkins helped to start a revolution." This is not my hyperbole. This is the considered judgment of a very shrewd New York Times editorialist. And I think with the help of the other book that has been written, actually two other books, both of which are reflected in our series of essays, Kirsten Downey's book, The Woman Behind the New Deal, and Corinna Gore Schiff, Vice President Gore's daughter's, Lighting the Path, Nine Women Who Helped Shape America, which features Francis Perkins. In the last 5 years, we have helped bring this remarkable public servant back to the limelight in America. And with what's happening to tear apart the New Deal right now in Washington and elsewhere at the state level, we think it's very timely for people to understand the motives and the energy behind a person like Perkins, who helped forge the contract between American people and their government. At the very beginning of our book that you have access to back is this quotation from her: The people are what matter to government, and a government should aim to give all the people under its jurisdiction the best possible life. This was very much at the core of Frances Perkins's idea. It stemmed from her social work background after leaving Mount Holyoke College. She, as many of you know, and if you're interested, it's on the website of the Frances Perkins Center. I gave a talk recently in Albany on the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Fire. Ms. Perkins was at the fire. She was visiting friends across Washington Square. She heard the fire engines clanging towards the building where the Triangle Shirtwaist was, and she watched many of the 146 people, mostly young women, jump to their deaths because there was no ladder on a fire truck that reached up to the ninth floor. So there was no way to rescue the people up there. And she would say later, and it's the key part of my paper, that the New Deal began on March 25th, 1911. She quickly became a member of the Factory Investigating Commission, which was started by the head of the Assembly for the Democrats, a fellow named Al Smith, and the head of the Senate, who was a fellow named Robert Wagner. And they made her their executive director to staff this legislative commission, which meant that it had subpoena power to require, including the owners of the Ash Building and of the business, to come and testify and respond to questions under oath. That factory investigating commission ended up making 30 recommendations over the next 3 years, almost all of which she organized. She sent Smith and Wagner and other members of the commission out at 6 o'clock in the morning to Auburn, New York, to factories to see people coming off the night shift and people arriving. In icy weather, she had Senator Wagner go out a window on an icy ladder that did not reach the ground, which was all they had for a fire escape. And as he said, it was the greatest education of my life. Al Smith said a comparable thing. So here this young woman in her early 30s, in a period when she was not allowed to vote yet because she was a woman, helped mobilize intellectually and with good research, which was her fort from her time at Mount Holyoke. She organized the legislative program, which became fully active in the administration of Governor Smith, who, of course, went on to be the presidential nominee in 1928. And his social reform leadership of New York, even before we hit the Depression, was carried on by Franklin Roosevelt as governor. She is continuous from both the Smith government governorship to the Roosevelt governorship. She's the only linkage, and she's the linkage that brings all of the legislative initiatives of those two administrations together. Then Franklin Roosevelt, as president-elect, asks her to come to Washington, which is a real sacrifice for her because her husband is a bipolar manic depressive, frequently institutionalized. This is all before we had drugs to deal with this kind of problem. Her daughter, who was in a very troubled marriage, also was bipolar. Her grandson, by the way, is as well, but happily we have the kind of medications that can take care of that. He's very open about this and realizes this is part of the family story. She says to Roosevelt, I'll only come if you will commit to support me in the following. And it included workman's compensation, unemployment insurance, collective bargaining, minimum wage, limited hours for women and children, Social Security, all of which, by the way, were accomplished. But her final one, which was not, was a national health care bill. And Roosevelt said he would. And she told me more than once, what you had to do with the president was to repeat what it is you had him commit to, and after you got that commitment, you then asked him to repeat it himself. And she said it's something that works very well with 10-year-old boys as well. And many of her male colleagues did not understand this management technique of Roosevelt, and they would leave a meeting where he had nodded enthusiastically to what they were saying and thought they thought they had a deal, and then found out later that he did just the opposite. But Frances Perkins knew him from not only 1928 when they started working together, but she'd known him all the way back in his state senate days. So she became, as Kirsten Downey's book explains it, she really is the architect of the New Deal as it relates to the domestic legislation that we label that way. Her resourcefulness in dealing with men is one of the great stories that Kirsten tells in her book. She realized very early that if she were going to deal with men, the best way in that era was to make them think of their mothers. And so from her early pictures, which you can see in several of the books that are coming out now, from the very pretty, somewhat femininely dressed lady, she started adopting long black skirts, severe blouses, and her tricorn hat. People had a feeling they were not dealing with a young woman, they were dealing with sort of a maternal figure. And it was very important. And for young women now to look at the Perkins career, I think, is really fascinating in terms of how do you deal in that era, how do you deal in a man's world? And it was a great consequence to Roosevelt that he had someone who steered these causes through. What we tried to do in the book, and I want to call on a colleague to share with you, we included stories of real people and what Social Security meant to them, along with essays from really some of the key people in the country who are defending Social Security or who have been its interpreters historically. Stephen Lowndes has one of the family stories in here, and I want him to do two things. One, I want him to read. This is a book signing. This will be the reading part of the book, but also to say something about the calendar driving with FDR, which also is available on the back table and is having its unveiling at this event today. It's an unusual calendar, which you may also want to secure. And Stefan and M.H. Freiberg, who is here with us as well, are responsible for the two Social Security birthday cakes. This is the 76th birthday, and you are to look at them before we have the cutting so that you can see that there are differences in the two cakes, which is part of the fun of the calendar as well, which has some hidden treasures in it. And Stefan has asked me to thank the Pastry Garden Bakery in Poughkeepsie, which has donated these cakes today in honor of Miss Perkins. So let me share the podium for the next couple of minutes with Stefan Lowndes to do his reading. Stefan.
My friends, first I'd like to thank my friend Chris Bryseth and his co-editor Kirsten Downey for including my story in A Promise to All Generations and for inviting me here today. It's truly an honor. As Chris said, first I'd like to read my Social Security story and then tell you about my calendar project afterwards. Social Security preserved my family. My father was a carpenter. He loved building things. He was almost 40 when he married and started building a family. My mother was a housewife. As part of the rent for our apartment in Buchanan, New York, my father helped maintain the building. On April 22, 1972, my father had a sudden, massive heart attack while tending the furnace in the building. I was 8 years old. I had 3 older brothers and 2 younger ones. As I watched the paramedics wheel my father's body out to the ambulance, I couldn't help but worry about who was going to support my family. After my father's funeral, my mother applied for Social Security survivor's benefits, which we began receiving within weeks. Each month, after our 7 Social Security checks had cleared, my mother, brothers, and I headed for the supermarket, where we filled 3 grocery carts full of non-perishable foods. 6 growing boys ate a lot. Although she started working after my father died, without the Social Security survivor benefits that we received, my mother could not have afforded to raise my brothers and me together. We would have been split up, and most of us would have been sent to live with relatives or would have been placed in foster care. Which is not to say that we lived extravagantly. We were frugal. But there were times at the end of the month when we were just about out of food. My mother always worried that she wouldn't be able to afford to keep our family together. My brothers and I all worked to contribute to the household. The Social Security benefits by themselves just weren't enough, although they later did help me pay for college. And that's my Social Security story. Now, I've been coming to the FDR Library since I was in elementary school. Little did I know that one day I'd be speaking here, let alone researching my own project. Which brings me to my 2012 Driving with FDR collectible calendar. I came to this project because I was working on a book about vanity license plates, and I found out that FDR was vanitized, both here in New York and in Georgia. As a matter of fact, his 1936 convertible with the hand controls that he designed is displayed next door in the library's basement, complete with his license plate, which simply says the number 3. While researching these plates here at the library, I came across some wonderful photos of FDR driving and being driven. I thought they would make a great calendar. So taking the advice of Francis Perkins, when a door opens, you must go through it, I decided to seize the opportunity and write and produce my own calendar. Along with these fantastic photos, I've included chronologies of FDR's life and of the World War II era, which is all explained on the back. And to entice you to study the photos a little more closely, and because it's just fun, I've hidden a facsimile of Chris Bryce's own FDR 1932 vanity plate in each of the photos for you to find. But what makes this calendar unique is the 4-page mini book that it begins with, telling a great story about how him being able to drive, even though he couldn't walk after being paralyzed by polio, affected FDR and changed world history. Now an excerpt. Together, Secretary of Labor Francis Perkins and President Roosevelt masterminded the Social Security Act, the New Deal's most important and enduring legislative legacy. I will be forever grateful to Secretary Perkins and President Roosevelt because the Social Security survivor's benefits that my mother, my 5 brothers, and I received after my father died made it possible for my mother to preserve our family. And as Chris said, I will be available to sign the calendars later. Finally, I'm truly grateful for the friendly helpfulness of everyone here at the FDR Library on this project, including Acting Director Lynn Bassanese, Archivist Bob Clark and Mark Renovich, and of Cliff Laube and Amy Northup. Thanks also to David Wallner, my friend Chris Bryseth, and of course to FDR and Francis Perkins. Thank you.
Well, with a calendar, there's all kinds of ways to immortality. That reflects the stories. The essays include the following. Adam Cohen, whom I've already mentioned and who has written the book Nothing to Fear. Karenna Gore, whose book I referred to already, on the 9 women who helped shape America. Kirsten Downey, who really is the major Francis Perkins scholar in the country right now, and an unusual piece that comes from the present exhibit that Lynn has invited you to. It's the letter that John Winnett wrote in 1936 to President Roosevelt, resigning as chairman and member of the three-person committee that oversaw the development and of Social Security, I mean, its actual implementation. And Winnett, who had been the Republican governor of New Hampshire and had already in New Hampshire done many things to help meet the needs of people in the Depression that would ultimately be reflected in the New Deal, John Winnett felt he could not remain on the board, which was a deliberately bipartisan board, given Alf Landon's attacks at the center of his campaign against Roosevelt in 1936, his attacks on the Social Security legislation. He pledged, it may be an echo that you hear, he pledged when elected to help tear down Social Security. And Winnett felt so offended by that he wanted to campaign for Roosevelt, which was one Republican governor opposing another Republican governor. So he resigned, and that letter is in the exhibit. And when I saw it in the exhibit, I said, we have to have that in the book. So John Winnett, and his, by the way, his son, Rivington, has died recently. He was on the board of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Institute, and John Winnett went on to be our most distinguished ambassador to Britain during World War II. The total length of the war was probably the most popular American in England during the course of the war. Unhappily, he committed suicide in 1948, which, given how we thought about that act in those days, virtually made him lost to us until recently, when another wonderful book by Lynn Olson called Citizens of London has literally brought his career back into focus. June Hopkins has written, and she's the granddaughter of Harry Hopkins. Nancy Altman has an essay. She's probably the chief historian of Social Security and what's happened to it from the beginning to the present. She was on the 1983 commission with Alan Greenspan to upgrade Social Security and save it from some pretty dire consequences at that point. And she is probably the leading interpreter of Social Security in the present public debates, along with Eric Kingston. And Eric also has an essay here. We have one from Teresa Ghilarducci, who is a specialist on what's happening to our entire pension system, and looked at relative to the Social Security system itself. And then we have an essay from Jamie Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith. It's probably the most controversial essay in the book. It questions the whole definition of the debt and of the deficits that we are seeing at the center of our politics right now. And finally, the two essays that David and I have mentioned, one from Senator Barack Obama and the other James Roosevelt's essay from this last August. In Eric's essay, and his book is called Social Security in the 21st Century and the Generational Equity Debate, he quotes Roosevelt in setting up the Social Security concept. And this is the president: "We are compelled to employ the active interest of the nation as a whole through government in order to encourage a greater security for each individual who composes it." Senator Obama had the following to say. "FDR understood," Obama explained, "that the freedom to pursue one's dreams is made possible by the nation's promise that if fate causes one to stumble or fall, quote, our larger American family will be there to lift us up. That if we're willing to share even a small amount of life's risks and rewards with each other, then we will all have the chance to achieve our God-given potential." What is happening in the current debate, and we're going to open this to questions, so your points of view are as relevant in all this as mine, is that what was adopted as a social insurance program in which, through our payroll taxes, we paid our premium. We, in return, got a life insurance policy for our survivors. We got an annuity for the rest of our lives. And we got the protection against disability should we be disabled again for the rest of our lives. That is insurance. That is not an entitlement. And what has happened, in my view, and it goes all through the latter essays in the book, is that the framing of this issue has been done by people looking at debt and deficits. It's been a framing of a fiscal issue which loses the sense of what Social Security was intended to be and has been for millions and millions of people. Namely, a program that was designed with the assist of our own taxes to be the fundamental protection for Americans as they face these major crises. So if there's one concept I hope this book will strengthen you as you debate this with your neighbors and your friends, is that Social Security is not an entitlement. And for those like Pete Peterson, who has been trying to frame it that way, what that has allowed them to do is to see that what we really probably should do is strengthen it for poor people and minimize it for middle class and upper middle class people. Well, that absolutely cuts across what Perkins and Roosevelt were trying to do, because they saw it as a support for all parts of the American family. And once it be seen as a program particularly for poor people, in our history, and I speak now as a fellow historian of David, that makes that program vulnerable. Every program we've had that's been focused on poor people has been vulnerable at the time that you come to real tough budget cuts. So Social Security, while it has some actuarial challenges out 50, 60 years, there are nothing that cannot be helped by some modest increase in the payroll tax, lifting the cap. We only now, I think, do payroll taxes up to $96,000 or something in that category. There's nothing that keeps that from cap from listen to wages up to $200,000. And a few other modifications like that, and it will be actuarially sound for another 75 years. It's, by the way, the only program besides Medicare that the federal government looks at out into the future. Medicare has many more problems than Social Security. But what's been happening in this debate is that Social Security has been linked to Medicare as at the kind of the core of the indebtedness of the United States. And as Galbraith will point out in his article, if there is a debt implied by the treasuries that will soon add up to over $4 trillion as part of the Social Security Trust Fund, that also, in accounting terms, should be regarded as an asset of the country as well as a liability. And if you haven't been thinking that way, I really urge you to focus on the Galbraith essay. My final remarks, and then I'll just open it up to the floor, is that what you will see running through all of these essays, including the historical ones, that is, share with us how this system came into being, is a moral dimension, an ethical commitment of each of us to each other. And that, from my perspective, is what's been almost totally lost in the way the deficit and recent budget discussions in Washington have focused on. And of course, with a committee of 12 in front of us right now, how they perceive this will be terribly important. One of the things that the Peterson Institute has tried to suggest in its analytic studies is that Social Security, frankly, will not be around for younger people. And I can tell you, in talking to younger people, they've bought into that. They assume it will not be there for them, and therefore they have to make plans that do not account on Social Security. This is a very clever attack, and it's right it's right congruent with the attacks that Governor Landon was making on the legislation when it was first adopted. So I hope the book strengthens your understanding of the system and arms you to be part of the debate, which is now in front of us. I mean, the future of Social Security, as well as of Medicare, is on the plate, and it certainly is going to be part of the 2012 election, and probably even before that with the report of the Committee of 12. The final essay by Jim Roosevelt, who is a member of the Roosevelt Institute Board and a very good friend of this library, takes the theme of the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And he outlines in very clear form how fear is being used adroitly to undermine Social Security and some of the other programs. As you may be knowing, in some of the states that have had changes of government in the last election, unemployment benefits are being unfunded by the states in terms of their part. In the state of Maine, which I'm now involved with, because that's where the murals were taken down in the Department of Labor, including the mural of Francis Perkins, because in the Department of Labor it should be a business-friendly building. And her name was taken off of the major conference room, which, by the way, we got back on by getting the two Republican local legislators to come to her home, understand the role that she played nationally. They, as Republicans, wrote the new Republican governor, and the Republican governor has put her name back on the conference room. So there's a point of being armed and fighting back. But the attack in Maine has been to increase the hours that teenagers are allowed to work, up to 26 hours, and to free them from the requirement to work for the minimum wage, so they are now allowed to be paid $2 less than the minimum wage. That pattern is being repeated across the country at the state level. So in terms of our federalism, it's not just what's happening in Washington, it's what's happening in the states that had this real sweep, like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and New Hampshire and Michigan and Alabama and Maine. So if eternal vigilance is required for liberty, I would say that for Social Security, eternal vigilance is required as well. Now, let me open this to your comments and questions. And Cliff, whom I want to thank at this point for all that he's done to prepare for this day, is going to get the microphone to you.
This is probably a very naive question, but why is it when anything has to be cut, it's always the lower class that suffers? Never the ones that have billions and trillions, but always the ones that have trouble putting food on the table.
David, do you want to help me on some of these questions? That's a spectacular question, and I think the very asking of it helps to answer it. I mean, I think money is power. I think also, and I'm reflecting on this issue a lot, because as we have the debates over the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest, if you argue with people who have great wealth, they have a very keen sense of their own entitlement to their wealth. And it's not that they're selfish. I mean, that's too simple. It's that kind of each of us thinks that what we've done, we deserve. The evil side of that is that the imposition is that those who don't have can feel it is their fault. And this, I think, has been a very prevailing part through American history affecting the legislation that we've adopted. What Perkins and Roosevelt and Hopkins and Ickes and Wallace did was to break through that and say that where we have systemic failure, as we did in the Depression, Our government is the means by which we try to set it right. The argument that's going now is, as the phrase "get government off our backs" started with Governor Reagan. I think the burden is to have a positive view of government's role in our lives. It is being seen in terms of its negative role in our lives. So I think politically, and I'm under no limitations here because I don't have any job. Politically, I think the critical issue for President Obama is going to be to sustain the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. And if he does that, I think that is going to be a major issue in the 2012 election, and we're going to have a fair debate over precisely your issue, because we have never had such a distorted distribution of wealth in this country as we have right now. The last time it was even close to this was 1929. David, do you want to
add? I would just concur and remind everybody that by far the largest contributors to both Democratic and Republican parties are the sort of corporate business community. They are the ones giving the money, the campaign contributions. So we have a kind of systemic problem, I think. We need systemic reform in so many ways. So they're answering to certain drummers, I think. And in Roosevelt's day, of course, he labeled the super wealthy who had too much power economic royalists. And he said in 1936, against economic tyranny such as this, the American citizen could only turn to the organized power of government. So it's a completely opposite philosophy.
And he also said he knew he was hated, and he welcomed the hatred of the economic royalists. Yes.
I read that the United States were not the first country to have Social Security. I believe it was Bismarck in Germany. Now, I was wondering, do you think that Perkins and FDR looked across the Atlantic to see how they did it and why?
I believe that Ms. Perkins' initial trips to Europe to study exactly that point came during Al Smith's governorship. It may have been during Governor Roosevelt's term, but she was very much attuned to what was happening in Europe. She helped persuade Roosevelt to join the International Labor Organization for the United States. It was the only League of Nations agency that we joined. And by the way, John Wynant became, after the election of 36, he became our official delegate to the ILO. Harry Hopkins was sent by Roosevelt to study exactly the question you're talking about. So they were very much aware that America was way behind the Western European countries in terms of this retirement social net. But yeah, it came from Bismarck in the 1870s. He's really the one that got it started. Yes, sir.
When were the funds actually extracted out of Social Security and replaced by paper sign off by the Treasury to say that they would backstop this in the future? I know there was a surplus, but why? What was that funding used for, and why now today we're going to be asked to pay that money back when the paper is actually needed to be used, so the people are paying again?
Well, and if you want to get in on this, there are conflicting ways to frame that issue. I mean, treasuries are in the funds. Treasuries are as good as the good faith and credit of the United States, which in the last week seemed to be in some dispute. But you have to ask, are we going to refuse to pay back treasuries that are held by the Chinese? I assume that the and Galbraith's essay really speaks to your question, that the to have a trust fund made up of U.S. Treasuries is a pretty good backstop. Now, your question points to what happened during Lyndon Johnson's administration, at which point the government started borrowing from the Social Security funds and substituted treasuries. As you know, there's no limit to the number of bonds the United States government can sell. It's not like your own personal bank account. There's not a checking account and said, how much money do you have behind your checks? We are the federal government, and I think the state of Vermont are the only two entities that have unlimited ability to create cash without limit, any legal limit. So as far as I understand these issues, the $4 trillion that will be in the trust funds in the form of U.S. Treasuries is about as good a way to hold that money as you've got. But your question suggests the fact that we did invade those funds in order to help pay for the Vietnam War. And what is, I think, a crucial issue going forward, and Galbraith, by the way, says Social Security and Medicare should be on the budget, and that we should be paying that out of revenues. That those obligations are every bit as important as paying our bondholders. That's a huge budget question. It's one that's not likely to come up to the Committee of 12, but until we are ready to face that, I think the trust funds are in as safe a place as they can be, with the one caveat that, of course, to deal with the present crisis, we've lowered the amount of payroll taxes that are being withheld, so that we are not funding it at the rate that the projections have assumed, and our employment levels are lower. So, and of course, our attitude towards immigrants is such that we are not allowing for the natural increase of the population of working people who are paying into Social Security. So there are a lot of pretty important issues that we're not looking at in their interrelationship because of the politics. And I don't use that word only nastily, but in this case I do. Do you want to add to that? Okay. Other question? Yes, ma'am.
How did the name Social Security emerge? Because I see that a lot of people get very disturbed over the name Social. So is there a way to to make that better? I mean, you said it's not an entitlement, you know, and that's obvious. But anything that's an entitlement, you know, can be taken away. And so we have to be able to kind of reframe this, whatever, to make it more palatable for the people who think that it's a socialistic program.
I can't give you the precise answer to that. It's in Kirsten Downey's book, if you want to look at what point that nomenclature came to be. The phrasing was old age pension system. When she asked Roosevelt in February of 1933 to support her in her various objectives, the phrasing was the old age pension system, and that picked up on what Bismarck and others have been doing in Europe since then. The phrase that I think is useful uses the word social, but it's social insurance. This is an insurance program, and it's a social insurance program. So I understand that social can be linked to socialism, which is still a nasty word in this country. But it was, as far as I know, maybe you've got a different answer, the phrase Social Security was part of the final act, and the Social Security card, which is reflected in these beautiful cakes back here, was the official name, and it became the Social Security Administration. So I don't think we want to tamper with that, but your point is a crucial one. If it's seen as an entitlement, it could be taken away. And given the contract, and this is why the title of the book is A Promise to All Generations, the promise was made, and people have paid for it. I mean, it's not as if this is a gift of the government, which one can see an entitlement being. This is insurance paid for, and we're pretty serious about honoring insurance contracts, although after 2008 and AIG, we know that even that's got some limitations. But your sensitivity on this is absolutely important.
The key word in 35 was the word security. And Roosevelt, in working towards Social Security, set up a committee in 1935 called the Committee on Economic Security. And Francis Perkins was the chair of that committee. And it's actually available online. It's a fascinating thing to read. And if you're really interested in Social Security and the history of it, I urge you to read it, including the cover letter, which is also fascinating because she talks about the impossibility of proposing national health insurance because of the opposition of groups like the AMA and so forth. So they decided to go for... But Roosevelt was very interested in the word security. That was the word that they were focused on, not social. Because how do we provide basic economic security to the American people in the midst of this horrible depression? That they felt that that was an obligation of the state. And also, it's interesting, from Roosevelt's perspective, you know, as time goes on, there's a lot of reflection that's going on in his mind about the Constitution, which is interesting given the kind of right-wing obsession with the Constitution. But he makes the argument that the Constitution was a great document. It provided political liberty, what we needed, but it didn't provide economic security. And so he says, we got to figure out, that's another obligation of the state and of society as a whole. So it was really security that they were focused on.
And the word that was really loaded at the time was the word dole. And if you read at the very beginning, Tomlin Coggeshall, Ms. Perkins' grandson, quotes Roosevelt as saying to her over and over, Francis, it can't be the dole. And Ms. Perkins told me more than once that they almost lost the president's support until they could convince him that the people who were half old, that is those people who were nearing the age limit, and they were to be covered by Social Security, were getting the dole. And he returned the legislation before its final passage to say, this is still the dole. So they had to work him through that. I think that captures the spirit of how people were understanding the commitment.
Aren't you leaving out the historical context here? I mean, while Bismarck, his government, which was ferociously right-wing, did create a system in Germany, he did that after he locked up the leaders of the Socialist Party, which was very, very large in Germany and threatening. And he did that to satisfy the German population that followed the Socialist Party so they wouldn't resort to a further uprising. Roosevelt wasn't blind to what was going on in the country. There were terrible conditions to which there was a violent reaction. I mean, the Teamsters Union led a strike in 1934 that actually took over the city of Detroit. We don't learn about this in school. But they brought in the army to put that down because the police refused to fight them anymore. Because it wasn't just the Teamsters, it was every union in the city that did that. There was a textile workers' strike in the Alleghenies that led to 500,000 people being out and exchanging shots with private security guards. And again, the National Guard had to be brought in. So he was working in this context, not just with Frances Perkins' good ideas. She got these ideas from Germany because Germany did it first. But France followed, and Italy followed, Denmark and Sweden, and they all had social democratic parties. And there was a Russian Revolution, to which we were, of which we were terrified at that time, that it would spread here. So there was something going on in the country.
Absolutely.
Not just Frances Perkins and her good ideas, although she was a great person.
Well, David mentioned that Roosevelt came to power the same month that Hitler took power in Germany. You had Mussolini in Italy, and you had Franco in Spain. And you had the great distress that you're referring to. I mean, we were on the edge having to use the military against crowds of workers, the bonus march on Washington by veterans from World War I. But on the other side of your argument, were things like Dr. Townsend in California, who was pushing the Townsend plan, and Huey Long in Louisiana, who were pushing for a much more populist kind of active government that was going to, in effect, provide the dole. And so many $100 a month to every person over the age of whatever it was, 55. So, the political pressures were not on Francis Perkins, they were on the president. But I think the argument I would make is that she was one of his most crucial allies in figuring out how to respond to those convergent pressures, which included the international ones that you and David both referred to. It was a very scary time. And until we get, in some ways, I mean, we have terrible strikes in 1937, the recession returns, or depression returns, when FDR decides to carry through his commitment in 1932 to have a balanced budget and pulls back on federal spending. And it's being talked about a lot these days by columnists. And really, until we get into the preparations for war, at which point our employment goes up, we are two steps away from some of the convulsions that are going on in Europe. David, with your permission, I'll tell my Jimmy Hoffa story. In the spring of 63, Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, was really onto the Teamsters and onto Jimmy Hoffa and the mob. And Miss Perkins, who was not particularly fond of the Kennedys because of her sense of their father, Joseph Kennedy, was invited by President Kennedy to come down for the anniversary, 50th anniversary of the Department of Labor. And she's very excited about this. We're in the house talking about it, and I remember the morning after she came back, she had been on the Today Show, and she said, "Can you imagine people waking up in the morning and seeing that old lady with a tricorn hat and saying, 'Is she still alive?'" Anyway, that story tells you a little bit, and the wonderful pictures of her with President Kennedy. Nonetheless, when Jimmy Hoffa is coming to campus, and the House members are in this house, the students own the house, so she was our guest, we invited her. We had to figure out, did we really want to have Jimmy Hoffa at the house after his big speech? And by the way, he had a standing room only audience in the biggest auditorium at Cornell. He was hot stuff at that point. And she had argued with us that we had one person, a faculty guest in the house who actually was a refugee from Hitler's Germany, who argued that Hoffa was the Hitler of the American labor movement and threatening a national strike, and that we should not give him any kind of recognition. And she said, I remember, she said, "If Mr. Hoffa lives," she said, "he'll be regarded as one of the statesmen of the American labor movement, just as John L. Lewis was." And she dealt with John L. Lewis her whole time as Secretary of Labor. But she did not want to be seen with him because of the Kennedys. And so she went to bed. And when Hoffa came down for the reception, and we had about 200 people at the reception, and I remember the third request from him to see Madam Perkins, one of our housemates went up and knocked on her door and said, "Miss Perkins, Mr. Hoffa really insists on seeing you." And she said, who the H told him I lived here? And then she said, "But never, let it never be said that a former Secretary of Labor refused to see a major labor leader." So Miss Perkins got dressed, put a tricorn hat on, and came down. And I remember so vividly, the place was packed. Hoffa was so short that he was sitting on our sofa; his feet didn't touch the ground. And everyone parted like the Red Sea parted to let Miss Perkins, who was herself diminutive and almost blind at this point, approach him. And he jumped up grabbed her hand and said, "Madam Perkins, I always wanted to meet you to tell you how good you've done in ending unemployment." She said, "Come now, Mr. Hoffa, you and I know that the New Deal did not end unemployment. World War II ended unemployment." At which point she pivoted, walked back, and as she was leaving the room, she recognized, even though her vision was so bad, the Teamsters lawyer. And she said, "Tell me, Mr. Zagreb, are the Teamsters still hijacking trucks in New Jersey?" And with that, she went off to bed without any photos being taken. But she was 83 at the time, and I think showed that she still was on top of her game. One last question, then we're going to take some do some cake cutting in the back, which we want you to observe, and then have the cake. And I will sign, and Stefan will sign calendars.
Yes. We must eat cake.
Well, let us all eat cake.
I'm a foreign language teacher, but I love history. And I should, maybe this is another innocent question, and I shouldn't even say it here, when Roosevelt said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." But I'm afraid for our country. There was a little song that says, "When empires fall, it's messy at best. And this one is falling just like the rest." And it compared it to the Holy Roman Empire. Armies all over the world. Oh, and the taxes, the rich, the optimas, they wouldn't pay anything. And the other ones, bread and circus. So I wish somebody would say, this is not going to happen to us. Remember Benjamin Franklin, "United we stand, divided we fall."
David, do you want to say anything to that? I have a final comment after that. It's a very large question, and I'm sure said in our own way is on the minds of everyone in this room. Do you want to?
Go ahead.
Well, I was born in 1936, and I take it as, in my understanding of generations, that those of us who were born in the late 30s were the most fortunate generation in American history. Everything has gone our way. And for those, our siblings who are younger and our kids, they have a much more challenging world to deal with. And so I am a congenital optimist. David can tell you this, even as he's tried occasionally to get me to be a little less naive. But I'm afraid that this last quotation I'm going to read from Jim Roosevelt's final essay is more pessimistic than I like to be, but I think it's riveting. This is now Mr. Roosevelt about his grandfather. "Social Security embodies my grandfather's determination to free us from fear by securing the American people against some of the, quote, hazards and vicissitudes of life," which was FDR's phrase. "It would be tragic if that nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance," unquote, was manipulated to destroy his greatest legacy. So I guess it's the purpose of this session this afternoon is not only to introduce you to our effort to bring this legacy in a way that can be used by people, but it's to focus on how important the issues are that are in front of the country and how much this library, which was FDR's own creation as a way of helping to instruct the future about our past, is itself a very important lesson, the library and all that it represents, to keep us true to some commitments we made back in the 1930s, which really represented a breakthrough in our whole history, which is why I think Adam Cohen referred to Miss Perkins as a revolutionary in the same sense as Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine. So, any final words? So, thank you very much. We'll see you back at the cake.